Mr. Chair, I will move approval of the April 4th minutes with a notation that I have not read them completely. So if somebody else has read them more completely and sees something, please call it to our attention. But they look, I think, fine.
Okay.
So I move approval.
Thank you very much, Representative Erickson. With that motion before us, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We're off to an efficient and effective 2020 session. Thank you. In your packets, members, is a memo from House Research. I believe it's Mr. McCormick specifically, but I could be wrong, discussing the new process, the everything, what, old is new again, process for moving bills between committees. The short answer is the memo process is no longer the way we're going to move things. Bills will go through by a committee report to the floor and then back again to the new committee if they need to move to more than one committee to move through our process. But that House Research memo is in your packet for the day. Oh, and Ms. Burt rightly points out, same rules as we had last session for this committee. So, simple enough. Today we are opening, much as we did last year, and as our deliberations did last year, centering the voices of students and parents in the educational experience in Minnesota's public schools. So we have again turned to the Minnesota Youth Council and others to bring us some youth voices, to be able to hear more directly from them what their experiences are. We've also got two parents who will be joining us later today. And if you look, members, at the agenda, you can see a set of questions that they were asked to focus their comments on. This hearing, I'm pleased, is also on TV, not intended as a message to make people more nervous, but it does give a broader slice of Minnesota the opportunity to hear these voices as well, which I think is important. With that, members, Hella, Ms. Henderson. If you, and you can certainly bring the students up with you if you wish. So just, Ms. Henderson, I'll use you as an example. Particularly for the students, when you come up and testify, I will specifically ask you to state your name for the record. All committee hearings in the House are audio taped, and those tapes go to the Historical Society. And if a researcher in the future wants to find out what Ms. Henderson had to say today, it's helpful for them to have that marker of an individual introducing themselves and connecting that with the voice. So, Ms. Henderson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Can everyone hear me? Mm-hmm. All right. My name is Hala Henderson. Can you hear me?
Mr. Chair.
Is that Representative better? Murphy.
Just so we don't interrupt when we're not supposed to interrupt or something.
Mm-hmm. I would say if you'd wait for the individual student to complete their testimony, and then we can certainly take questions. Okay, thank you. How are we doing on the sound check?
Is that better? Wonderful.
I think so.
My name is Hala Henderson. Thank you, Chair Dabney, and members of the committee. As I said, my name is Hala Henderson, and I am the policy coordinator for the Minnesota Alliance with Youth. And I have the privilege of working alongside several of the students who will be speaking here today from the Minnesota Youth Council. As the only legislatively mandated youth council in the nation, the youth representatives who serve on the council are able to provide insight to policymakers like yourselves on issues pertaining to Minnesota's young people. We are made up of 36 youth members from between 8th and 12th grade, with 4 students serving from each congressional district and 4 at-large youth members. Our council is diverse, not only in geography, but in background, socioeconomic status, and ideology. Nevertheless, 5 times a year, our youth reps come together to bond and plan how they can best serve the state and the 325,000 plus high school and middle schoolers across it. In addition to that, we host Youth Day at the Capitol, where hundreds of young Minnesotans come together to advocate for youth voice. This coming fall, we'll be holding our biennial Youth and Educational Leadership Summit, which is an entirely youth-led day of trainings and workshops. We believe that providing young people with spaces where they are the experts and where adults take a back seat are ways to build confidence and create meaningful systems of change. Over the past 6-plus years, since Representative Marquardt introduced a bill in 2013 that created the Minnesota Youth Council in its current iteration, we have worked along state agencies such as the Minnesota Department of Education to provide needed insight into their systems. The Youth Council's work with MDE, I think, can best be found in their work on the Minnesota Student Survey. It's a prime example of what they're able to do through the addition of phrasing and additional questions which might have been missed or not thought of by the adults who work there. Young people are able to ask really nuanced questions pertaining to mental health supports, school safety, and school climate. This year, we've focused a lot on holding conversations with commissioners and agency folks to share experiences and point out holes in policy. And our reps attend meetings to share their stories and also to provide feedback. One of our youth representatives currently serves on the Children's Cabinet Advisory Council to provide it much needed insight from young people and to bridge the work that the cabinet is doing with the work of the council. In addition to showing up in spaces such as this, we believe that to be effective, our youth representatives also need to be seen, not only at the Capitol, but also in the communities that they serve. They have hosted community forums. They have created social media platforms to engage with their peers on the importance of youth voice. And they've worked alongside community partners to advocate for issues that, that Minnesota's young people care about. Through their work on the Minnesota Student Survey, community outreach, the MYC survey that they released in 2018, and research that the council has utilized through external research, we believe that continuing to have a strong interest in mental health supports, school safety, and educational disparities and educational outcomes for students of color is where we will be moving forward. As we have in years past, the reps will hold bill hearings this year, and they will ask tough questions. Excuse me, my throat is very dry. And offer feedback on how legislators can tackle these pressing concerns. It feels also necessary to acknowledge that while young people have opportunities to reach people in positions of power, it isn't always easy to get folks to listen. Therefore, we are so grateful for the opportunities for such spaces like this where youth voice is prioritized. Prioritizing the voices of young people is not just something we should do, it's something that we must do. When we talk about school climate or academic disparities, we need to talk to the experts. That includes teachers, EAs, caring adults in the buildings, but it also means students. Who better than the young people who sit in our schools and show up to class each day? We have thousands of young people across the state who have knowledge to share, and when we provide them with the space to do so, results will follow. As you can probably tell, I am very proud of the young people that I'm allowed to work with. I'm continually impressed by the level of awareness they possess and their ability to think of solutions for complex problems. At the Alliance, we recognize that we can't do our work without young people leading the way. We are proud to work within a model where young people are at the forefront of the decisions we make. No decisions about young people can be made without them at the table. And once again, we are so grateful to the members of this committee for providing the space for them to do so. I would like to thank Chair Dabney and the committee administrator, Sarah Burt, for continuing the conversation on student voice. We appreciate your commitment to providing young people opportunities to share insight, and we look forward to continuing to work with you in the future. Finally, I would like to thank the young people who continue to take time out of their busy lives to educate adults like myself. they're missing school and braving frigid weather to be here, and we appreciate their time and their energy. I ask you to bring your attention to the young people who will be speaking next, and I thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Ms. Clancy, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Daphne. My name is Ava Colette. Sorry, I'm getting over a cold. My name is Ava Kalenz, and I want to start by thanking you so much for taking time right at the beginning of session to listen to the voices of young people. I'm incredibly grateful to be sitting here and representing my peers and my generation, hopefully speaking on the issues that matter most to them in our educational system. I am a junior at St. Anthony Village High School, which is a small public high school right outside of Northeast Minneapolis. I am a captain of the swim team, a member of the green team, and a member of the National Honor Society. I am in the concert, pep, and marching bands. I am also the chair of the Minnesota Youth Council, which, as previously mentioned, is the only legislatively mandated body of young people in the country, tasked with lifting up the voices of young people in the state legislature and state departments. The MYC is important. It has the potential to have a significant impact on the lives of the more than 1 million children in the state, and I am so proud to serve among such dedicated and thoughtful members on the Minnesota Youth Council. However, I am here to talk about my experience as a student in Minnesota, and I'll start with my junior year. As junior year was approaching last year, countless counselors and teachers and parents and upperclassmen repeatedly told me that this was not only the most difficult year of high school, but the most important, and that was a lot of pressure. Just like me, most of my peers are handling a full and intense course load and a resume full of extracurriculars and volunteering and work. Those who are on a trajectory to attend a form of post-secondary education after we graduate are taking rigorous college-level classes. The ACT is happening in right about a month, but my classmates and I can't even find time to study for our classes the next day, much less the ACT happening in, I think, like 32 days. The stress of junior year and all of high school is visible in my peers, and the student support needed to make it through successfully is lacking. Many of my peers are aware of and care for their mental health. However, the appropriate resources are not available to us. In my school of about 1,000 students, we have 2 guidance counselors who coordinate scheduling and 1 mental health counselor. The recommended counselor to student ratio is 1 counselor to 250 students, and I doubt my school's extreme ratio is an anomaly in the state. It is troubling to see my friends and my classmates go through this kind of stress and to experience it myself. And I think it's important to also state that what's often forgotten is that students are real people with real responsibilities and real intense lives at home that are often forgotten when they come to the classroom and are given tons of more things to do. In addition to the loads of classes and extracurriculars that are expected of us, especially if we want to get into a college and get into it with scholarships, which is necessary for most students who don't have the funds to be able to go wherever and whenever because college is so expensive. Students may have stress or additional responsibilities at home that they need to seek counsel for. Making resources and counselors available to students for guidance in the endeavors of their futures, mental health support, and basic navigation of their academics and life would reduce the unnecessary stresses and pressure that school creates. Again, thank you so much for taking time to listen to the voices of young people this morning. As session continues, I hope you take these things into consideration. Please remember that students have real big things going on in their lives. Please listen to students and take their words seriously. Please consider that the community you represent includes more than those who can vote. And please never forget that there are always young people in your community willing to share their experiences with you. Thank you again so much, and I yield my time to the chair.
Thank you, Ms. Clancy. Ms. Dickinson. Is it Mr. Arquin?
Arquin.
Apologies. I'll let you two decide which of you goes first. Just please, again, introduce yourself for the record and then proceed. Welcome.
Okay.
is Haley Dickinson. I first want to say thank you to everyone here for making time and space for youth voices. It is so crucial and so important, and it says a lot about the priorities of the Minnesota Legislature. So my name is Haley Dickinson. I am a student at North St. Paul High School. I am a junior. So I'm going to start talking about an experience that I had last year as a sophomore, because I think it sets the stage for a lot of what I will address today. So last year, shortly after winter break, we had a lockdown, not a lockdown drill or an active shooter drill, but an actual lockdown. A student had brought what turned out to be a replica handgun into the school and was flashing it at students. And I think that we can all agree that we care about school safety, but in reality, there is a lack of clarity, a lack of seriousness, a lack of understanding around procedures and the real threat of gun violence in schools. So you would think that after the administration found out that there was a gun in the school, that that's when we went on lockdown, and that was not the case. We continued throughout the day with the simple precaution of shorter passing times, and no one told students what was going on. Later, we went into lockdown over a social media threat, and following this is when things really started to get messy. So we went into lockdown, we were still in our classrooms, and after the lockdown was over, we were basically told to keep working, keep doing what we were doing, go on with the normal school day. And a student in my class ended up having a mental breakdown. The response from the teacher was to punish them by giving them detention for being on their phone to call their mom. Following this, the school day ended. All of this was fairly close to the end of the school day. So there was only about a half hour left of class once all of this was over. So we go outside and there are cameras and press everywhere. And at this point, students still don't know what was going on, even though parents were alerted. And so this whole experience really opened my eyes to not only the threat of school safety, but that schools are very unprepared to deal with that threat. So my big takeaways were that there needs to be more transparency to students. We need to be looking at the procedures that schools have. As mentioned in our situation, we had been, I think that the administration was experimenting with some different terms, and students weren't familiar with the terms, teachers weren't familiar with the terms, so that just added to the confusion of the entire day. In addition, we need to address that there is a disregard of the danger and threat of guns in schools. I want to be very clear that I'm not just basing this off this one experience, but we have had more threats than I can count on one hand. And with that, I would never trust my life with the school's administration, because they're simply not prepared to take on that threat and to come up with the appropriate measures to protect students in the school. This leads me to mental health. Mental health in schools is horrendous, as should be very clear. The student to counselor ratio, I believe, is 1 to 723 students. As Ava mentioned, that is a very accurate statistic. In my school, we have about 2,000 students on average, and we have 4 counselors. Also, to be very clear, counselors are not mental health professionals. They are generally career counselors. They are helping you with classes. They are helping you with rescheduling, anything along those lines. And so not only are they not prepared to help with mental health, but they act like it is an inconvenience when you visit them, because they have so many students visiting them all the time about various things. And school is unnecessarily stressful as is, and it is very crucial that we have mental health access, specifically for low-income families and families of color, because there is less of an opportunity to gain that access outside of school than there if it is not present in school. One other thing that I want to mention is the truant policies that schools have. So I have a friend, she's an adult, I go to school with her son. He has a chronic illness, and so he misses a lot of school. He is now doing online school. And so he was gone a lot from school, had doctor's notes, and even with that, she had to deal with the school, she had to deal with the court for him being absent so much. And this got to us talking about what other families are there, what other families are showing up because their children are excluded from school, and are put through so much more that is unnecessary. And so I guess that what I got out of that is that, is it really the best approach to put these families who are already struggling through more, to have to deal with court, to have to deal with the school, deal with extra precautions, in this case, something that wasn't even necessary considering that it was a legitimate reason for them being absent. Finally, I go to school in the East Metro. It is a suburb. However, our school is very diverse. We have less than 50% students who are white. However, the teachers and the culture has not changed along with the students. Talking and interacting with people whose siblings had previously gone to the school, it used to be a very white school, wasn't very diverse. However, the students have evolved and changed, but the teacher and culture has not. So this comes back to the teachers of color, lack of teachers of color. There are 4% teachers of color in the state, and having to have student voice present in decision making about the schools that they're in. So overall, I would like to see more of an effort to listen to students, for transparency to students, better access to resources, and a willingness to change.
Thank you, Ms. Dickinson. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Dickinson, for your testimony. Not a specific question for the mm-hmm. testifier, but it brings to mind what, and if somebody can maybe get back to me on this, but what crimes are schools mandated to report to police? Is there, either through statute or through the Department of Education, are there certain crimes that they're obligated to report to police? And again, that we can do a follow-up later, that would be fine. Thank you.
Ms. Perra?
Mr. Chair, Representative Juergens, I don't have that at my fingertips, but I can follow up with the committee and send that information around.
Thank you very much. Mr. Arquin, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Audrey Arquin. Thank you, Chair Dabney and committee. As I said before, my name is Audrey Arquin. I am a sophomore at Central High School, just a few miles up the road. As you well know, schools across the state of Minnesota differ wildly. Schools, especially in the Twin Cities, are very different, and even in one school district here in St. Paul are very different. I'm only one student from one school, but the disparities that we face at my school need to be heard by this committee. Last week, I was working with some fellow students from schools across the state, schools like Minnetonka, Champlain Park, and Eden Prairie. Within the first few minutes of talking, I noticed a clear difference in the education we were provided. Every day, I walk into at least two classes with at least 40 kids in them. Every day, I walk into three classes where we do not have enough chairs or tables for the number of students. And every day, I walk into my classes knowing that these classes aren't even the biggest at my high school. Over my year and a half at Central, I learned to deal with this problem, and I'd expected that every student across the state of Minnesota had to deal with this. However, when talking with my friends from other schools, I quickly noticed a key difference, especially when comparing our AP Human Geo classes. My class has around 35 to 40 kids in it. When I went around the table saying that, people were shocked. Apparently, as I now know, at Minnetonka there were 18 kids. At Champlain Park there were 25, and at Eden Prairie there are only 28. Class size is one of the biggest problems we're dealing with at my school. And it's having really dire consequences for both teachers and students. Having a relationship with teachers is one of the most important things that students can have. It helps students better understand what the teacher is trying to get them to know, and it helps the teacher better understand what kind of student they are and what support they may need. Imagine you're a teacher that has 40 kids per class, having to teach five classes a day. There is almost no way that any teacher could get to know one of their 200 students that they have to teach daily. This has led to problems in our classrooms, leading to them being more dysfunctional, leading to kids not being able to pass as many classes, and leading to a lowering in our graduation rates. Class size is one of the biggest disparities we face when it compares urban schools to suburban schools. But even within our own school, there are even more disparities for students of color. In a school of almost 2,000 students, around 70% of our students are students of color. And over my 2 years at Central, I've had zero teachers of color, and I know of only four that teach at our school. Teachers of color are so important for students of color because it gives them another avenue for them to learn from teachers that understand them and have teachers that they can look up to more. It's especially important for our low-income students who rely on teacher support to help them succeed in future life. Our low-income students and our students of color need the teacher of color support, and we right now do not have enough. Teachers of color aren't the only disparity that we face racially. When you walk into our school every day into the front office, you'll notice a wide diversity of students. Almost a third of our school is Black, a quarter Asian, mostly Hmong, a quarter white, and the rest is mixed from there. But if you walk into any AP, honors, or IB class, that level of diversity drops drastically. In one of my classes, AP classes of almost 40 students, there are 4 students of color, 3 of them mixed, including myself. Even the layout of our school has racial disparities. If you go up to the 3rd and 4th floors where the nicer, newer classrooms are, you will see a majority of white students. If you head down to the basement and the bottom 2 floors, it is almost entirely students of color. Schools across the state face many problems, many of which are similar, as we've discussed, with school safety and mental health. However, there are disparities that are faced by urban schools here in St. Paul and Minneapolis that need to be recognized. Disparities in our class sizes compared to suburban schools. Disparities in our faculty representation compared to our student body, and disparities in our education based on ability tracking, which is based on race. Thank you, and I yield my time to the chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the questions I think you were supposed to answer according to the directive we received from the committee administrator is what makes you a successful learner? So would both of you comment on that? Please.
Ms. Dickinson?
Yeah, I think that what makes me a successful learner is that I'm very independent. I take it upon myself to get my stuff done. I focus. However, that's also coming from the perspective of a white middle-class woman who is very privileged. And so I can safely say that I have the access to resources that other students I don't believe have. And so I think that that is another crucial point of why there is a difference in students who are not picking up stuff as successfully, not picking up material as successfully, and why my experience in education has been very different as opposed to those of other backgrounds.
Ms. Durkin?
Going off what Haley said, one of the things that has really helped me is I've had the ability to have support systems. I've had parents that understand how school systems work and had the resources to help me. We have had access to good mental health care, which has been really helpful for me, seeing that our school services, especially in St. Paul, do not offer very good mental health in schools. And especially coming from upper middle class family in areas of St. Paul like McAllister, Groveland, which have a much higher that have much higher resource availability and much higher incomes. It hasn't been as much of me being a successful student doesn't have to do as much with my schools and my teachers, but more of the support systems I've been given through the privilege I've had.
Mr.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. Are you, Audrey, a PSCO student, as it notes here in our agenda? Would you comment on that?
Mr. Erickson.
I am not. That is a misprint on that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Adelson. Excuse me.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to thank both of you for your courage to stand up on some of these issues for your fellow students. I've said it for years. We passed Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. 66 years later, we're still struggling with some of the same issues around disparities, around making sure that your teachers reflect the students within a school. I just want to thank you for your courage for standing up.
Thank you. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, thank you both. I'm following up a little bit with Representative Erickson's question on what makes you a successful learner. One very instrumental book that I read was Paul Tough's How Students Succeed, which talks about the ability to overcome adversity and resilience. How do you think that has played into you? Is that a skill that you've acquired? Is it something that we all have adversity? We all come from different places. We all come from somewhere. I'm curious. Tell me how adversity and resiliency play into your learning development.
Mr. Arkin?
Well, as we all know, school is a hard thing. We have hard classes, there's hard assignments, and there are things that we need to learn from. And throughout people's school lives, there are other challenges that we'll face, whether they be socially and through other things that help build adversity. But in my opinion, we do not want to have this adversity built through problems that are systemically affecting people of color more, affecting low-income students more. These students should not have to deal with more challenges because of their position. And we know that adversity is a part of your high school life and it's part of a young person's life, but that should be built through things that do not have to do with their race, do not have to do with their income, do not have to do with their sexual orientation.
Yeah, and I think that has
Ms. Dickinson?
I think that has to do a lot with equity. I mean, when I think of equity, I don't think that everyone needs to be on an equal, everyone needs to be equal all the time. But when you walk into the school, everyone should have that equal opportunity to do well. It comes back to the access of resources that lack outside of school should be made up in school. And as Audrey mentions, it should not be, adversity should not come from your gender or your race or your sexual orientation. It should come from your experiences and your hobbies and your different belief systems. You know, it shouldn't be something that you were born with that sets you up to fail.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And a follow-up to the testifiers. I appreciate the answer. However, I'm gonna press you just a little bit more. I'm gonna make this. I'm gonna give you a little bit of a chance to deal with resiliency and adversity. An example for me growing up was, I suffered a number of challenges, whether just as we all have growing up, and I had to overcome those. One of which was reading and some other skills that I didn't have. I was able to take that and turn it around and actually excel in areas that I didn't think I could. I also did that in some athletics. That's what I'm asking about is, I mean, when you come up to a problem, no matter what your background is, how can you take an obstacle and turn it into a success? And is that still important in education today, in your opinion?
Ms. Joaquin?
Well, I'm going to use your example. You said that you were struggling reading and you struggled to, and that you were able to turn it around and get better at it. And I think that we want to give the same opportunities to students like yourself. We need to have the resources available for students that are struggling to be able to help themselves and be able to turn it around. I know what you're saying, that it's important for students to grow and learn from their struggles. But in some areas, they need the support that is given. And especially now that we're coming into more diverse schools where students very well do not know English to the same level and need more support systems, issues like that are becoming more common. We need to be able to provide resources for students in order to help them excel and help their backgrounds excel. So I think what we're saying is that the adversity and challenges are still there for students. And like you said, I'm going to bring up reading again, that we need to provide the right support systems there for they so they can help accomplish their goals.
Mm-hmm. Representative Crescia, any follow-up?
I didn't know if the other...
Oh, Ms. Dickinson.
So I don't have an example like mm-hmm. yours. My experience with education and challenges, I was a very good student. I was an A student all the way through like end of middle school, beginning of high school, and then my grades began to decline, largely because classes got harder, because I was in an advanced position from what I had previously been in, and then had taken on like different advocacy things and different aspects of my life outside of school that made it increasingly difficult. I do want to comment. Earlier you mentioned asked if he was a PSEO student. I am. So I'm an online PSEO student for a large majority of my classes this year, and that has been the biggest blessing to have that experience. It is, as I mentioned, I'm very independent. From my perspective, it is an option that should be utilized more in schools because a lot of students are stressed by having to go to school 8 to 2 or 3 every single day and be there when there are other things that they would like to be pursuing, where there are other things that they would like to be spending their time doing. And so my school is definitely moving towards that, but that is probably one of the pivotal moments in my life where I've been able to kind of turn around my experience with education as it was declining.
Sure.
Mr. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And response, and thank you both. I'm certainly not trying to put you into any answer, and I'm not looking for any. What I'm trying to get to is where the right, I understand toxic stress. I understand what it's like to be in those situations, as well as watching children come from very different homes that struggle with that. All I would say to this is I'm just trying to find the right line between, as someone who's been in the education system and a mentor, as we all have, there's a way to use obstacles and adversities and challenges to help people become better than what they are today and to reach their full potential, as well as understanding the toxic stresses that you've laid out. So that was just the line of questioning I was trying to get to. Thank you for your answers.
Thank you. So I've got two more members with questions. Representative Detmer is up next, and then Chair Youakim. And then I'm going to want to move on along because we have other student and parent testifiers who have more to share. So Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is my mic on? Okay. Testifiers, looking at your school, do you have college fairs where colleges can come in and talk about opportunities and careers? And do does your school also invite the trades, like plumbers, electricians, and so forth, come in to talk about the opportunities in the trades? And does your school also invite, the military recruiters to come in and talk about the opportunities that we have in our military?
Mr. Arkin?
So in our school, we do have many college fairs. We have colleges in almost every week. I do not know specifically of any trade specialists come in, but we do very often have technical two-year colleges come in. We've actually, going on your third point of military recruiters, we've actually come into some problems with military recruiters in our school, where we've noticed that there's been specific targeting of minorities in their advertising. Many examples we've seen throughout the past year have been students that have been walking through the halls, and it's a group of students, both students of color and white students, and only the students of color have been pursued by the military recruiters. So that is just one example of how military recruiters are coming into our schools, but we have access to all these other opportunities.
Ms. Dickinson?
I'm really glad you brought that up. We do have military recruiters. We do have college fairs. But another issue that you bring up that I think is very important to address is that there is a lack of knowledge and bringing in plumbers and really whoever of different career paths that don't involve college. I personally don't know if I see myself continuing with college after high school, and so it's a lot harder to see different options and if that is the right option for you when those resources are not being presented to you in the public school setting.
Representative Detmer, any follow-up?
Mr. Chair, just thank you. Just a follow-up. You know, there's a lot of opportunities out there for our young people. And the trades is one of them. Our state of Minnesota has a real lack in the tradespeople. I know I talked to the electricians. If you get a 5-year apprenticeship right now to be an electrician, you're being paid while you're learning. You get benefits, and the starting salary for an electrician right now in Minnesota is about $75,000 to $80,000 a year, and there's no debt. There's no college loan. So a 4-year education is not for everybody, but we do need young people to get involved in our trades, and there's some great opportunities there. And also in the military, there's some great opportunities in the military. Most people know, I have twin sons that went on to West Point Military Academy, and they're having a great career and are serving our country. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank the students who are so eloquently speaking on a complex issue facing our schools and how to reach kids where they're at and make sure that everybody has a chance to succeed. You painted a beautiful picture of what the difference is between equality, giving every student the same thing, and equity, giving every student what they need to move forward. And I think you did that a lot better than some of adults can. And I just want to thank you for that.
Very good. Thank you both for your time today. Next on the list is Jayla Diamond and Nathaniel Janine. So if you'd both come down, please. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Diamond, please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Center, Intermediate District 287. student at SECA, you get more one-on-one support. SECA is an alternative school in Richfield, and one thing I can say with no doubt.
Ms. Diamond?
Yeah.
Can I ask you maybe lean in a little closer to the microphone and maybe use a little bit bigger voice if you can, all right? Thank you.
Being a student at SECA means you get more one-on-one support. SECA is an alternative school in Richfield, and one thing I can say about SECA without a doubt is that they've welcomed me back with lumbering arms every time I've decided to come back from a new school. The staff at SECA really helped me understand why I was always so mad and why school and blocking out the negativity was so hard for me. Students at my school have access to groups and activities. As my years went by at SECA, I have gotten involved in many things, such as AVID, peer mentoring, Black History Month projects, girls rap group, student council, and last but not least, our student equity group. SECA staff never let me forget my potential and how far I can go in life. They give me support with all the rough patches I was going through. I wish every kid could be fortunate enough to have the support system I do at my school. My school is smaller, and because of that, we have higher staff to student ratios. Since I don't live with my parents, I don't always have a way to get to medical appointments. And for students like me, we have access to the PLUS program through Headway Emotional Services. With that, I have access to rides to school or to appointments. I am given access to homeless services through Oasis for Youth, and I have access to a therapist at school when needed for emotional support. Some of the hard things are at my school that sometimes students smoke in the bathrooms, and there are conflicts between fighting students. Some of the barriers that I have experienced are being in the child protection system, not always having a way to school, not knowing how to process my emotions without resulting to violence, being highly mobile, drama with other students, lack of motivation, lack of staff to recognize the strengths that I have, and other challenges that my friends have faced are similar to those things: teen pregnancy, drug use, addiction for themselves and or family members, and poverty. Things that make me a successful learner are having support from my teachers when I am stuck or need extra help. Having a choice in what I am working on or learning is important to me, like working in my equity group on Black History Month projects. Having ownership and leadership opportunities is very important to me when it comes to learning. When my teachers notice me and what helps me, that helps me a lot. And having emotional support at my school is important when I am having a hard time emotionally due to the things that I go through at home.
Thank you very much, Ms. Diamond. Mr. Janine, and to the committee, Mr. Janine is the student representative to the Minneapolis Public School Board. So he gets the special privilege of being at all the school board meetings. But lending a youth voice there as well. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you for having me. Mr. Chair and committee members, good morning. My name is Nathaniel Janine. I'm a junior at Washburn High School in South Minneapolis. I've been with MPS for almost 12 years now. I currently serve, as said, on the Minneapolis Public School Board of Education, and I also serve on the Minneapolis Youth Leadership Council as an executive officer. I just want to say thank you for giving me this opportunity to share, well, giving us all this opportunity as students to share our opinions, concerns, and let our voices be heard. If there's one thing I want to tell you about Washburn and my school is that there's a lot of stigmas. Who can be involved? Who can succeed? And most notably, who belongs in a class? At Washburn, 15 kids got the IB diploma, you know, kind of the gold standard of a high school education. It's really hard to get. All 15 of those students were white. And Washburn's a very diverse school. We're about 45% students of color. And, you know, I can tell you dozens of stories of students not feeling comfortable in an advanced class. I can tell you what it's like to be a sophomore considering going for that IB diploma, looking up at that wall of all white recipients and kind of thinking, you know what, maybe it's not for me. And I literally sat down with a group of 20 students yesterday, eighth graders from Justice Page Middle School, all of whom were students of color, many. They did not come from positions of privilege. And I tried to stray away from only talking about AP. They like to ask me about high school. But when I did get around, I asked them, are you prepared for what comes next? Are you prepared for AP? Are you interested in taking AP? I got one of two answers. What is AP? And that doesn't sound like it's meant for me. And, you know, it's talks like these that have shown me the true disconnect and disparities that we have at Washburn, and that, unfortunately, that's the reality we have right now. On another note, Washburn is overcrowded. We have students who sit on the ground during lunch. They have to stand during lunch. And on days like these where it's really cold out, it can get really bad, where you have a dozen to two dozen kids sitting in the hallway eating lunch. My Spanish class, I think the class I'm missing right now, we don't have desks. We just sit in chairs in like a U, and we have whiteboards, so like this without tables. In my guitar class, it's not in a music room. It's in an old science lab. But I think most importantly is that when you have these oversized classes, it's hard to build a relationship with a teacher. It's hard to get that one-on-one. It's hard to have that feeling that your teacher understands what you're going through and where you come from. And, you know, this added with, I hear this from many of my peers and across the city, our teaching staff does not represent the demographics of MPS. I think in my 12 years, I've had one black teacher, and he retired last year. So, you know, when you have this disconnect, it makes it hard for students to have a teacher to talk to, a counselor to consult. I know kids to this day who still don't know who their counselor is. And to be honest with you, you can't create an environment. You have to create an environment where students feel comfortable. Like, how does it? The school is a second home, basically. And you're going to have to be comfortable well after the bell rings. You're going to have someone to talk to, someone to fall back on, having an adult there to help you out. Maybe if your parents didn't go to college, if they don't have that kind of background. Because I believe you cannot create a successful learner solely inside of a classroom. It takes much more than that to create a lifelong learner, a student who is excited to learn, and a student who is intellectually curious. I know you've created a successful learner when you have a student that is ready for what comes after high school, not because of what their parents told you, but because they receive proper preparation for what comes next. If it's through proper mentorship programs, a quality college and career center, or career tech guide, the most successful learners, the ones who go on to create the biggest impacts, are the ones who spend their summers exploring their interests, their weekends going to Quiz Bowl, debate, robotics, math tournaments, etc. The students who consider the classroom a floor, not a ceiling. And while I do believe straight A's and a high SAT score can be valuable, I don't think they define a student's success, nor does it define their possibilities. But with that said, I just want to say thank you again for giving all of us this opportunity to come share our concerns with you today.
Thank you very much. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're both so articulate, so thank you for being here. But Mr. Janine, would you consider becoming a teacher since you recognize this disparity and it seems to me you have all the skills and talents that would be so good for our young people.
Yeah,
Mr. Janine.
I'm sorry. I think I've talked to Ryan about this. I would only become a U.S. history teacher. It's the only class I could teach.
And as a former middle school social studies teacher, that's a fine choice. Yeah. Representative Detmer, I'm sorry.
And I'll just repeat my question that I had the last testifiers. In terms of career counseling, does your schools bring in colleges, universities to talk about education after high school? And also, do they also bring in the military recruiters to talk opportunities in our armed forces? And also the trades, are they allowed to be brought into the schools to talk about the career opportunities in the trades?
Ms. Diamond, do you want to bat first on this one?
So for me, my school, they do bring in colleges. Being an alternative school, I am proud of that they do take the time to have colleges come in and look at us, you know. And it's not just two-year colleges either. They'll have four-year colleges come in sometimes too. Now with the certain, the trade people, we don't usually have people just come in and talk to us, but we do have a teacher that is really good with helping us move in that direction if that's what we're interested in, and we all do know that we can go to him if that's what we need to do.
Mr. Janine, how about Washington?
Yeah, so we do have a college and career center where schools can come in if they want to talk to students. We do have a career fair, I think, once a year in our gym. As far as trade schools, I think last month we actually, from what I remember, we had, I think the first time we've had someone come in from a trade background and talk to students, and I think they did it for 2 days, and that's all I can basically remember.
All right. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Janine, I had the opportunity to visit Washburn High School about a year ago, but it wasn't for a full tour. It was specific to the lunch program. Hmm. I'm wondering, and I was very impressed with that. I was wondering, how are the school lunches at Washburn?
We talked about this.
Mr. Janine?
Yeah. I think they're fine. I mean... I mean, yeah, I think we've come a long way since when I was in elementary school, and I do believe that we have improved our lunch program.
You know, Representative Juergens, I imagine they raised this with you, but the Minneapolis schools food program is nationally award-winning and includes, what do they call it, farm to school?
And that's the program I was
yeah.
there to see.
Yeah, no, no. They did admit when I toured, I think it was Lindale Elementary, that the beautiful watermelon radishes weren't a big seller with the you know the elementary kids, but they were tasty. But that was farm to school.
I think I had those radishes when I visited too. But and it was a farm to school program. It was a fresh food, and it was you know I thought it was better than just okay. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, yeah. Enough to get me to swing by for lunch
too.
Any other questions for these two students? Seeing none, thank you both for coming and testifying today.
Thank you.
At this point, we're going to do a little bit of a transition to bring parent voices in. And we've got two parents who've been willing. There's more than two parents in the room, I recognize. But there's two parents who have come to share their children's and their family's experiences with us. Ms. McGill and Ms. Anderson.
Andreessen.
Oh, sure enough. Look at that. So Ms. McGill, Ms. Andreessen. As with the youth, I'll let you two arm wrestle as to which one of you goes first and just ask that you introduce yourself for the tape so we know who you are and then proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you.
Ms. McGill, I can tell by the sweatshirt.
My name is Monica McGill, and I am representing Excel Academy, which is a public charter school in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. Mr. Chair, I would like to begin with what my hopes were for my children and going to school. My hopes for my children were to have the best possible education and and for me to be able to have a voice in that education process. Since having them attend Excel Academy, I have had a tremendous voice in what my children's education is all about. Because it is a smaller environment, I don't have to go through a lot of politics to get what I need for my kids. If I need to talk to the superintendent of the school, I can just text her or I can call her. I now volunteer at the school because I am disabled, so I have to have something to spend my time doing, so I spend my time at Excel Academy every day. Helping students, I've worked with Reading Corps, helping students learn to read. I've done a lot of stuff. I am now on the board of directors. It's just, I don't know, the atmosphere there is just so warm and loving that I wouldn't want my kids to go anywhere else. I have had one of my daughter went to school there from pre-K all the way through eighth grade. She had a different experience with another charter school. She went from eighth grade to ninth grade at a high school charter school. She went there the whole year, and then the next year when she enrolled, it closed a couple of days before school started. So I had to think quick, and what I did is I just enrolled her in our district school, which is Wayzata High School. She completed Wayzata High School and graduated last year. She is now going to Georgia State. She was able to transition from going to Excel Academy, with no problems. She had no problems with any of the educational things that Wayzata offered as opposed to what she learned from Excel Academy. In the 11th grade, she told me the things that they were doing in math was the things that she had learned at Excel Academy in 7th grade. So Excel offers a very phenomenal education. We have some of the highest reading and reading test scores in the state. We really have some of the, of all the schools in our area, in the area where the school is in Brooklyn Park, they have some of the highest reading and math scores. So they're outperforming the schools in the area, and most of the schools, I believe they're outperforming Osseo in a lot of their test scores. They really work with the kids on the level that they are on. We have what this is called win time, and it means what I need. So we test our kids at the beginning of the school year and find out where they are with reading and math, and then they put them in these groups every day for 45 minutes to give them what they need. So if they need help with reading, they give them help with reading. They need help with math, they give them help with math. They don't need help with any of those things, then they get to do something else that they maybe are lacking in. We recently bought our building, so we are able to expand and have go from having one middle school class for each grade to now we're gonna have two middle school classes next year, which helps a lot with some of the kids that the class sizes, our sixth grade class size is huge, but it won't be next year. So it the ratio will be a lot better and the kids will get more of what they need because of the smaller class sizes. I don't know, it's kind of hard for me to talk because I just don't know what to say. It's just a wonderful environment. And I've worked in Minneapolis public schools before I got sick. And I think the best thing for my kids was to be able to have a choice as to where they went to school because it fit their needs a lot better than being in a bigger school. My kids are, even though they went to Wayzata and it's a huge school, my daughter really expressed that she wished that she could have gone someplace smaller. Now, I do have a son who's now at Wayzata, and the good thing about that is he's in the 11th grade right now, and he should be in the 10th, and when he was at Excel, he was tested. I was able to voice that I felt he needed to be tested to get out of kindergarten, so he spent 2 months in kindergarten. I spoke with the superintendent and the principal, and we had him tested, and he was able to move up to first grade in after being 2 months in kindergarten. And he has not had one problem with social behavior, education, anything since he got put a grade ahead. And he is now in 11th grade at Wayzata. So he's on track to graduate, and he wants to be a civil engineer when he graduates. So I think it is important that people know that charter schools are public schools too. But it gives parents a choice as to where their kids can go to school and what type of education that they get.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. McGill. Ms. Andreessen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Shannon Andreessen, and I'm here today to talk to you about my two sons in their experience at Hopkins Public Schools. They are in the 6th and 11th grade, and they access services across the educational landscape from accelerated learning to special services. And I hope you'll indulge me as I share highlights from my son's education so far. And I'm nervous, so I'm just going to read what I've written. My eldest entered kindergarten able to do simple algebra in his head, yet he couldn't tie his shoes or make friends. But he got himself a champion in his kindergarten teacher who mentored him and fostered his exceptional gifts as she became the gifted and talented teacher at our school. In first grade, she arranged for him to work with a volunteer who came in once a week to help children with exceptional math gifts and because there is no accelerated math program for children that young. She then went on to craft a creative schedule that allowed him to access accelerated learning, again, that was not available to first and second graders in our schools. She did the same for my younger son when he entered kindergarten reading at a third grade level. In fourth grade, she recommended that we accelerate my eldest son by a year, and in that time, he started receiving AVID services along with all the students in his elementary school. This is a great program for students who struggle with executive functioning like my son, but it became unavailable to him in junior high due to lack of funding. All this time, my eldest was receiving special education services and private support services, which I brought into the school to help him succeed socially and emotionally. We accessed District 287 gifted programming, which is fee-based, and parents provide transportation, but we stopped after it became clear that his special needs were not supported through this program. So we supplemented his education through enrichment opportunities that were carefully selected to follow his special interests. His mentor then recommended that he apply for the U of M Talented Youth Mathematical Program, which is a fee-based, and again, parents provide transportation to the U, and he started that in sixth grade. Going into seventh grade, he was offered Accelerated Spanish, a program that disappeared the following year due to lack of funding, and a program called the Autonomous Learner Model, which is a Socratic-based gifted program that should be expanded to include all students, but is currently only available to top performers. In junior high, I was told repeatedly that there are no services for students who present like my son, who is twice exceptional, meaning he needs accelerated learning and support services. There were no resources to provide the social-emotional support he received in elementary school, and we all know what that means. There just weren't enough staff to meet all the needs in the school. This lack of support had real impacts on his education, so in eighth grade, I cobbled together volunteer teacher support from teachers who went above and beyond, stayed after school to help my son be successful. In ninth grade, his class experienced three deaths, two of those by suicide, and the community responded by raising money through the Hopkins Education Foundation to establish three wellness centers for each of our secondary schools. I hope that you see by my sharing these examples that many of the supports and programs that my children need are volunteer, community, private, or fee-based. I call my family lucky, but I've learned we are not. We are privileged and rich in resources. Generally, the system works for us, and when faced with a barrier, we have the resources to fight through it, and we've landed in a really good place. Through my community work, I've met many families and parents whose stories do not end like ours. Mental health issues that land their child in the hospital or worse, lack of supports that render accelerated learning inaccessible to their student, students languishing in programs that lack academic rigor, crowded classrooms that make learning impossible for sensitive children. Many of these services that address these issues are funded in Hopkins through our Education Foundation grants. And I guess in that way, we are lucky. But in Minnesota, educational outcomes should not depend on your zip code. We need more on-ramps to services and more trained staff to implement those services, both special education and accelerated learning, mental health services, and housing stability. Too often the onus is on the student or parents to fight for services, and you can't fight for what you don't know is possible, and you can't fight for what isn't there. When schools are fully funded, this insurmountable barrier disappears because scarcity disappears. What made the difference for my family? It was people. Those gifted educators armed with the tools, the time, and the resources to help, who see you and your child and believe in their success. Our schools are chronically underfunded by the state, increasingly dependent on property taxes and unstable funding like grants. And this is where we've arrived. We no longer can afford the people needed to educate our children. And this essential educational asset cannot be outsourced. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for either of the parents? Members, in your packets, you also find written testimony from a Ms. Montgomery. Yes, Ms. Montgomery, whose son attends Roseville Area Schools. That's it. Ms. McGill, Ms. Andreessen, thank you both very much for coming and sharing your children's and your family's stories with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, next week, members, we'll be meeting in our regular times. We're looking at bringing in some of those entities that received money from this committee last year to do a check-in with them on where they are at with providing the programming that they received the money to provide and how that process is going. It's an informal check-in with them. We expect different recipients to be at different stages in their process, and that's okay. We just want to check in and exercise some of our oversight functions. So with that, members, stay warm. We are adjourned.